this chair out of the way? I don't know.
And just, I have to leave by...
Well, good afternoon. We're going to call a meeting May 15th, the House Committee on Land Use. We've got a couple bills today we're going to have public hearings on. And the chair has had some personal business that came up outside the building, so we're going to go ahead and hopefully have a couple more members join us. But I, out of respect for everybody who's here on time, I'd like to get started. So our first bill on the agenda today is Senate Bill 462. You want to give us just a little brief?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 462 addresses composting, specifically in the Portland metro area. And today you have three amendments before you. I don't know how much detail you'd like me to give you on those.
It's good. Senator Devlin is here. Yeah. See Senator Devlin.
Can I approach the chair?
Sure. You want to?
Thank you.
Well, stand at ease.
I'm going to wait for the rep.
I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 462, and I'm going to ask Mr. Will Gehr, if you're here, if you'd like to come up and present to the committee.
Welcome. Thank you. Yes, my name is Will Gehr. I work for S&H Landscaping Supplies and Recycling, which is the doing business as name of S&H Logging Company.
Can you speak up?
And pull the microphone a little closer to you. Speak up just a little bit.
Thank you.
Is that better?
Yes, please.
Okay.
Sounds better.
So I appreciate the opportunity to come and testify. I realize that you received testimony a week ago, and there weren't any people who were opposed to the proposed amendment to 462. I don't have any problem with the base bill itself. I think what it proposes is valuable in terms of additional opportunity for public input early on in the process of permitting such facilities like composting. However, the amendment, at least the amendment that I'm targeting, is Representative Parrish's amendment that hopes to prevent composting facilities from locating within 1,500 feet of schools. And that's basically what I'm addressing in my testimony. Just as background, S&H Logging is a 20 to 30 year old company that has been in its current site. It operates a landscaping supply business and also a recycling business. It recycles yard debris and wood waste. And it processes both of those on site at its yard on Stafford Avenue off the I-205 exit, Stafford Road, I-205 exit. It's in the unincorporated Clackamas County area between the towns of West Lynn, Lake Oswego, Tualatin, and Wilsonville. So it's this area that's just outside of the urban growth boundary. It's in the urban reserve, as was pointed out last week's testimony. And it's slated for future development because of its very good access to I-205. It's one of the remaining, it's one of the only remaining areas in the metro region that has such good interstate access that it is going to be impossible for this area to escape development in the near term, 10 to 20 years at the outside. So our idea all along is to locate our composting facility in an area that where it's only going to be an interim use, where we understand that development, other types of development are happening or going to happen, and this is going to be the highest and best use of this piece of land for us in the interim, and that it will basically be pushed aside ultimately when the whole area gets developed. And the reason why we need to start a new compost facility is that, as I already submitted in some testimony that I sent to each of you as emails, I'm not sure how many of you had a chance to look at that already, and in fact, I'll start reading my testimony in just a second, but I wanted to give you a little bit of context before I did that and not read the whole thing because it's 3.5 pages. So in essence, we are forced to move our facility from our existing compost facility from the Clackamas Industrial Area because the county, about 2 years ago, bought the property from the former landowner and has had a study done which shows that it has a higher and better use as an industrial park of some nature, combined office, campus office buildings, as well as manufacturing. And our current activity does not really fit that mold very well. So we're on a month-to-month there, and we handle a good portion of Clackamas County's yard debris. And as you all know, there's a state goal and also county and metro goals to reach certain recycling levels. And we play a part in that. So we're proud that we contribute to the overall sustainability of the region and of the state. And I'm sure all of you agree that that's a worthwhile enterprise. In fact, our neighbors also accept that it's a good thing. They just don't want to see it near them. So the thrust of my testimony is to show you why I think that this proposed amendment to restrict the location of our facility, to prohibit the operation of our facility, or the permitting, I should say, the DEQ permitting of our facility, because we're within 1,500 feet of schools, why it's misguided and inappropriate, and why it should be defeated. So I'm going to start midway in my written testimony. The rest of it is I'll present for the record, and this should only take a few minutes. So I met with public groups several times before I even started the land use application process, and that I want to make sure people understand. The schools never were a part of those meetings. The schools were noticed in the land use application. I'm not quite sure why the schools and or the parents at this point claimed that they weren't noticed soon enough, and why they didn't have enough input into the process, because they were noticed. And I think we only got one or two comments in the design review permit phase, which was after we had already gotten our land use application. And at that hearing, at the land use application hearing, very few people showed up to actually oppose our permit. So I'll start reading now. As further evidence of a long, multi-layered, and thorough permitting process, our next task is to obtain a DEQ solid waste facility permit and a metro license. The DEQ permitting process starts with a screening process, which established the level of potential risk associated with the proposed activity. The DEQ screening application was submitted in May 2012, and the DEQ's evaluation was completed in January of 2013. DEQ staff concluded that due to the size of the proposed composting facility, as well as the close proximity of neighbors, the facility posed a potential environmental risk for odors and other emissions, as well as for surface water contamination. This level of risk requires us to submit an operations plan in which we will show how our operations will avoid these potential impacts. We have made two significant changes in our proposal to address these potential risks. First, we are downsizing the facility size, and second, we are modifying our stormwater management to prevent all releases to the nearby creek. The odor and bioaerosol concerns are being addressed with a composting method that has been tested and shown to reduce gaseous emissions almost 100%, actual 98.9%, compared to standard open windrow composting, which is the typical method of composting at most composting facilities in the state. A consultant's report is attached to this testimony. This was prepared for DEQ to provide them with a methodology for assessing the risks for impacts from odors or bioaerosols. DEQ's approach to regulating solid waste facilities is decidedly performance-based rather than prescription-based. The Dash 10 Amendment is just the opposite and should be dismissed as overreactive and misguided, both for its effect on its intended target, SMH, and in general. Prescriptive remedies do not allow for the constant evolution of technology and improvement of methods. The composting industry is fertile ground for overall process improvements and lessening of potential impacts. For example, the composting method that we propose to use, which is called aerated static pile with biocover cap, is relatively new and now, and just now, being evaluated by DEQ staff. It would be the first, ours would be the first in Oregon to use both positive aeration and the biofilter cap. There is another one near Corvallis called the PRC composting facility that uses negative aeration with a biofilter cap. And this technology has been used for at least 2 to 3 years in California, Canada, and other states like Washington. So it's not that new. I targeted this method even before I applied for the land use permit and have always had confidence that it would prevent impacts at this site. Since then, as luck would have it, an exhaustive $400,000 study in Southern California has confirmed its effectiveness. Essentially, this method is the equivalent of adding a 2,200-foot buffer around our facility as compared to open windrow composting. 2,200 feet. There are a lot of facilities in the state that use open windrow composting that have well less than 2,200 feet of buffer around the facility to the nearest resident. Some have less than 1,000 feet. Some have less than 400. There's one with 50 feet. Many of these facilities have sterling records of few odor complaints, not to mention the lack of complaints of increased symptoms from bioaerosols. I would like to now turn my attention to why adding the Dash 10 Amendment to SB 462 is a bad idea. Number one, the proposed amendment is ill-conceived. Its one-off nature has made it illogical and inappropriate. Our residents living full-time in homes less than 1,500 feet away from composting facilities any less in need of protection than schools? How about daycare facilities or retirement homes? Everybody is due equal protection, I think. Is the House Land Use Committee capable of evaluating the science of bioaerosol risk assessment? In spite of the emotional testimony, I doubt that any of us has have a grasp on this, and misinterpretation is rampant. Scientists don't agree on the potential risk of bioaerosol exposure, and even admit that some exposure is critical to the healthy development of children's immune system. Of course, some people are sensitive to common bioaerosol levels and must be protected from overexposure, such as working at a compost site. However, over the years, there has been periodic concern about aspergillus, or other bioaerosol emissions from compost facilities, and each time the allegations that composting is dangerous have come to nothing. I have been told by my consultants that there is not a single documented example of composting facility bioaerosols causing illness in the surrounding population. That said, of course, I think there should be a performance standard related to all emissions, and that is exactly what DEQ is requiring. My point is that DEQ is better able to evaluate than our legislators. Number three, DEQ has a site-by-site approach to evaluating composting proposals. They are rightly concerned about the close proximity of our neighbors and are holding our feet to the fire to prove that we can operate without creating unacceptable impacts. The permit is not a foregone conclusion. In spite of our good neighbors' fears and emotional pleas, it is inappropriate for this robust regulatory process to be preempted. I understand a local representative's interest in serving her constituency, but there is an inherent conflict of interest in this process, and it should not overly influence others' opinions. This is not good democracy. This is bad governing. Number four, another way in which this proposed amendment is ill-conceived is that it ignores the fact that many schools promote and engage in composting on campus. Granted, these compost bins may be small, but turning the material by students, who often do it by hand, exposes them to much higher levels of bioaerosols than the level to which the local school kids around us would ever experience from our compost facility. Would all on-campus composting be banned by this amendment? According to DEQ, there has been no notice of ill effects or complaints of odors at the middle school in Deschutes County that has an open windrow compost facility within 1,500 feet of it. Remember, that's open windrow composting, not at all like what we're proposing. Our emissions are almost 100% less than their method. Number six, the odor nuisance created by the North Plains facility is caused by a completely different set of circumstances which will not be duplicated in the slightest by our facility. We are starting from the ground up, will not be processing food waste, and will use a composting method that is heads and shoulders better. We have years of composting experience and know what management is necessary to mitigate dust and aerosols. A knee-jerk reaction against all composting and a one-size-fits-all prescription is not the appropriate way to respond to this. In summary, S&H is still in the midst of an exhaustive permitting process which is meant to adequately safeguard our neighbors. At both the county and now at the state level, DEQ, our specific location and proposal is evaluated with ample and emphatic local resident input. Our feet have been held to the fire every step of the way, and it is still not guaranteed that we will convince all regulatory agencies that this can be a good fit. We are doing our best to carry on our business and our valued service in a somewhat dysfunctional regulatory climate where the best locations are not available for this use. You heard a bit about this last week. Ultimately, this is a land use issue that would be appropriately addressed by this committee. While we support SB 462, the base bill, the proposed Dash 10 amendment is a misguided attempt to preempt the existing site-specific regulatory review process. The DEQ is the appropriate agency to assess risk and to assure environmental and public health safety and have in place rules to guarantee this. That's the end of my testimony. I'm also attaching the consultant's study that we commissioned, and I'd be happy to address any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Guerra. Thank you for coming today and submitting your testimony. Scott Corin. Oh, Senator, would you, well, Mr. Corn, just wait just a second. Representative Parrish and Senator Devlin.
Thank you. Chair Cameron, members of the committee, for the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37. We're just up here very briefly. You heard our testimony the other day when we had the first hearing, but we wanted to let you know that we're in support of the Dash A12 amendments. I think the testimony you just heard might have been about the Dash 10s, but those are kind of no longer in consideration. I think we believe we split those off from the amendments that Senator Starr and Senator Olson wanted for their amendments, so we've kind of separated those two issues and put our concern in the Dash 12. In listening to some of the testimony, and I have not had a chance to go through all of SNH's testimony, but one thing that did catch my eye in the testimony was kind of, and I don't know where the details came from, was with particular regard to the composting facility in Deschutes County near the school, that there had been no complaints about that. And I did just get off the phone with the folks at Solid Waste in Deschutes County, and they said that they have had some complaints from the school. The problem there and the challenge there is that the facility is also solid waste and a composting facility, and so it's not really clear what's causing the grief with parents and people in the community when those calls come in. So there's really no discernible way in that particular situation to say that it's their concerns that when they call are compost versus landfill. And I also have a call into the vice president of High Desert, vice principal of High Desert Middle School to try to just kind of get some feedback from them as well. But I would say it's not necessarily quite a fair representation to say that there's no complaints. We just don't know if those complaints are landfill or are compost driven. So we do support the A12s, Dash 12s. We still do strongly feel, I think, let Senator Devlin speak, but I know I still very much feel that citing a facility like this near school without really solid data about that there isn't health concerns and some of the concerns that members of the community have raised, that should be taken into consideration. And I appreciate that SNH, I've been a customer for years and appreciate the service that they do provide to the community. But I think when we do the planning piece, we just need to be thoughtful about where we're citing these. And with that, I will turn that over to Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Representative. Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. I think myself and Representative Parrish made very clear our views the last time the committee considered this particular bill. We are obviously in support of the bill. I would point out that in our support of the bill, the underlying bill is talking about a more extensive process for the siting of these facilities, which is something that this particular facility was not subject to. And it was brought to you by three members of the Senate, Senator Starr, Senator Olson, and Senator Roblin, who actually have seen some of the impacts in their communities of these types of facilities and believe that there needs to be a more extensive process. So while the representatives of SNH have indicated that they went through a process, it was a process that was in many cases somewhat limited in terms of public comment and in terms of what was prescribed in terms of basically defining what the issues were. I have heard, but I have not verified, that the school district was not actually notified of the land use decisions for the facility, and I don't know if you want to verify that or not verify that. But one of the things that I think is really important here is when you hear about all this discussion and you say that there may or may not be actual health impacts, I think there is evidence out there, if you search the literature, that there are potential impacts. There have been identified impacts. In the European Union, there are a number of countries that are actually have in place 250-meter buffers from not just schools, but from any residential facilities where they are occupied on a normal basis. And I think there is an indication here in the testimony that, you know, this facility may be here 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, depending upon the ultimate redevelopment of the site and ultimately whether it comes in the urban growth boundary. But that's 5 years, 10 years, 15, 20 years that the school, that the children at Athey Creek will be exposed, and the children at Stafford Elementary will be exposed. And I think if it was in our districts or if it was in your districts, you would actually have some concerns about a facility of this type being located so close to school children who are more vulnerable than the average member of the population to some of the issues that the bioaerosols present. And I would urge you to support the Dash 12 amendments and amend the bill with the Dash 12s and move the bill out of this committee to the floor.
Any questions for the senator?
We have also have Dash 13s.
Committee members in front of you, Lynn has taken the different amendments that we have in front of us and kind of highlighted what each one of them does. So
the Dash 13s were...
Senator, did you also have the Dash 13s? And is that...
Senator...
You really want the 12s and the 13s, or the 13s? Just the 12s, not the 13s?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Unger, I think we both participated in actually the crafting of the Dash 12s. The Dash 13s were to address an additional issue that Metro has brought forward, but we are actually both settled that the amendment that we both support is the Dash 12s.
12s is what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Got it.
And I'll just add, Senator Devlin mentioned Athey Creek and Stafford, and I think in my previous testimony I also mentioned that there's Stafford Academy, which is just a little ways over the freeway. There's also actually two other schools, and I totally forgot to mention them in the first testimony. There is a Montessori school on Borland, and if you recall, when we served, those of us who were here and served with then Representative Cannon, now serving in the governor's office, he taught at Arbor School, which is also on Borland Road and just a stone's throw from this as well. Probably not quite the 1,500 feet, but I haven't taken a tape measure out. But there are some other additional facilities that have students in that area, and we know that this is kind of a limited type of issue. But I think, as you've heard us say, we both feel pretty strongly that we want to try to protect the health of children. It's our goal. So,
Senator.
Mr. Chairman, trying to keep this short, but I do think there's one other comment I should put on the record. Having read most of the documents relative to this particular case and having reviewed the design plans for S&H, the composting portion of their operation will, I believe, under those plans, be on the southern portion of their site, which should still put them well within the 1,500 feet, actually probably put them less than 800 or 900 feet from actually the playing fields at Athey Creek. In that plan, there is a plan ultimately, once they have removed the soil that they're going to use for other purposes on the north side of the site, to move that facility to the north side for composting, which will put it actually just directly across the street, actually from the playing fields for Athey Creek Middle School, and then they will actually remove some of the topsoil for some of their other products on the southern portion of the site. So at first, it's probably going to be less than maybe 800 feet, 750 feet from those playing fields. Afterwards, it's going to be literally directly across the street.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you very much for your
testimony. Thanks. We'll have Scott Corwin. Welcome, Mr. Corwin.
Thank you very much. Thank you, members of the committee, and Senator Devlin and Representative Parrish. I am Scott Corwin. I'm an attorney, but actually practice in energy policy these days. But I'm a parent of two children at Stafford Elementary and associated with Friends of Stafford and other neighbors and parents to express the concerns of the hundreds or thousands of parents, not just of children at those schools, but children all around the area that use the sports fields, baseball, softball, soccer, lacrosse, tennis, right across the street from this proposed facility. And rather than reiterate testimony from before or parents or the testimony of the chairman of the board of the Westland Wilsonville School District who appeared before you, I'd like to address a couple things that I heard from S&H and also support the Dash 12 amendments today. S&H mentioned this as only an interim use. But they also admit that use may be 20 years or could be more. It's intended until these urban growth boundary changes. That's a long time, potentially, for daily exposure for 1,100 school children during the day and even more after school on those fields. They say this is a new proposal. What is the potential to expand beyond the proposal? How proven or different really is this new approach to aeration? What's the continued risk of surface water overflow? All serious questions, or this for the single paved layer prone to cracking to create groundwater risk. It's a relatively new method. They admittedly say. But their consultant paper, when you read it, admits that there's been that they did not do odor measurements in the studies at this other facility, which incidentally is in a much drier area down in California. He also states that bioaerosols are very difficult to measure, and there's no standardized or regulatory measurement methods for those, and that the control efficiency of a biofilter cap on bioaerosols has not been measured. That's what they're talking about here. Biofilter means just previously composted material you just lay on top and blow air underneath and have it go up. So there's still a lot of potential for release into the environment. You could have birds and other any facility that's not enclosed is subject to other material moving out of the facility, either from animals. They don't have any sense or notion of having a complete washing facility for trucks coming in and out of the facility, at least not on the permanent plan. It sounds like experimentation, and I don't believe school children should be subject to experimentation when they're directly across the street. They may not be proposing the worst industry standard here, but that doesn't make it anywhere near the best either. The best that we see if you in a simple search around the web or discussions in the industry are fully enclosed sites with indoor offloading, encapsulated bay processing, air extraction and aeration systems linked through biofilters, permanent truck washing facilities, this capping compost with other composted material, putting up berms, maybe some trees that may take 20 years to grow to create a boundary does not come anywhere close to creating a comfort level around the schools impacted by these. They critique these amendments as one-off. You heard, frankly, this egregious proposal created the focus on this at this time, and these amendments are needed to prevent similar situations from occurring. The county rules were unable to address the needs of this sensitive population, and DEQ rules are similarly constrained. Whether there should be a broader look by the committee during the interim is a different question, but this is an exigent circumstance now crying out for immediate action. They also they played on the risk of bioaerosols, and what I've attached to my testimony is this review of the literature. And this was in 2007 even. There may be studies even better today. But I see some misstatements in the testimony from SNH saying that there really is no threat here. There is a threat, and it's not just to compost workers. There's clearly in these studies, just take a look at the first few pages, and you see it is regarding the surrounding community as well. This is to respiratory systems and general health, airway symptoms, and it's linked to the proximity of the facilities, clearly in the studies. I'm not an epidemiologist, but neither is SNH or their consultant or anyone at DEQ, as far as I know. These folks in the research are. The reliance on DEQ here in their statements causes even greater concerns. They haven't demonstrated the resources to be able to conduct this kind of complex modeling on bioaerosols and emissions. They're willing to try and again to experiment, but once a facility is built, it's there to stay. And the mode of operation at DEQ is to try to work with operators, which is fine as far as that goes. Unfortunately, it means the facility keeps emitting and we keep trying new things. That's unacceptable here. This attack on the motivations of legislators, I hesitate to even comment on that he just raised, but suffice it to say this company has a record of public complaints and violations on public record at Clackamas County, DEQ, and Metro, and I don't see support from anyone locally for this project. If there was, we would see it. I don't see an industry association supporting siting of these next to schools. And I worry about this characterization by them as well as just fear from parents in the community. When there were hundreds of furious parents at the meeting that DEQ held on this, they were not just expressing fear. These are well-informed, intelligent people who have read this literature. They are concerned because their fears are well-founded. SNH says in their testimony, they, quote, believe they will not hurt anyone. Their belief and their latest operations plan does not reassure the rightly concerned parents and neighbors of this area. In summary, there's a gap in our state laws. It needs filling before it's too late. It's clear there are risks of health impacts. Those risks are greater when they're closer to humans. The method proposed here cannot assure the safety of these children, and this is no place to conduct some trial and error experiment testing various attempts to control dangerous impacts of this operation. I thank you for this opportunity, and I urge a passage of the Dash 12 amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Corwin. Any questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Good to see you again.
Good day.
Let's go to Mr. Rich, Dennis Rich.
Dennis Kitch. Sorry.
Oh.
Bad spelling.
Well, I'd rather be rich, huh?
Yeah. Never be rich.
Sorry, Mr. Kitch.
Yeah. Kitch?
Yes, Kitch. K-I-T-C-H. My name is Dennis Kitch. I am opposed to the, I believe it's the Dash 12 amendment. I have been a long-term customer of SNH. I have bought their products. I have taken a lot of material there for processing, and I am a sustainability consultant. I've worked in sustainability fields in agriculture, and I've worked in public policy on composting. I believe that a composting facility is a critical infrastructure piece, a well-run composting facility. I have visited dozens of composting facilities around the United States, Canada, Europe, Japan, Taiwan, Korea. A well-operated composting facility, by their very design and the operational perimeters that they have to operate on to achieve good compost, should limit bioaerosol exhaust. If it's too dry, if the material is not well handled, then you will tend to get bad compost and you will get bioaerosols. The studies referenced by the previous testimony, specifically the Cornell study of 2007, have not truly identified any high risks other than for workers, site workers who are in a confined area and in immediate contact. This is an OSHA or occupational safety and health concern, and it would be something that SNH would obviously have to be involved in. The concerns of the neighboring parents, I've attended several of the meetings to listen to their concerns because I'm interested. I believe we have to compost our green waste. I live in Lake Oswego. My material, my neighbor's material, has been composted at SNH for, transported to SNH, and then further transported on. That's a lot of diesel, a lot of transport miles to process this. Now, many, many people go to buy the compost. It's a beautiful business model. You pay them to take your waste, they process it, and then you buy the product back from them. It's a value-added product. And believe me, it's a very, very good product. It is organically certified, and we've had very good results in the garden. Most importantly, composting facilities nearby the source point. The yard waste produced in that area is a tremendous amount, and it should be processed close by. Over the years, I visited SNH sometimes a dozen times in a day when I was in a construction project taking construction wood debris to be processed there. They operate a very good facility. They follow their process control, and their industrial hygiene is very, very good. As I said earlier, a well-operated composting facility in order to produce quality product has to be monitored and instrumented. And if it gets outside of those perimeters, then things are gone wrong. The compost isn't working. It's like brewing beer, making bread. It's a yeast activation. Healthy yeasts are a healthy thing. And in the EU, I've seen composting facilities completely contained in an urban environment as an industrial facility. I've seen them out in the country. In Japan, of course, you know it's very crowded. They do very limited small facilities. If it's operated correctly, it should not smell bad. That's the critical thing. Bioaerosols, I've been in some bad ones, and they were not good. They didn't smell good. Those were operating, processing food waste. My understanding is they will not be allowed to process food waste at this one. So I urge you to consider public policy requirements. We need to have these composting facilities, and they can't be put in agricultural lands. So where else are you going to put them? We need it close by. We generate hundreds of thousands of tons of yard waste, and it needs to be processed. I believe that they'll do a good job under the right requirements from DEQ. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kitch, and apologize for the name. I think that, we've got Randy Tucker. Welcome.
Thank you. Vice Chair Cameron, members of the committee, Randy Tucker, Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. I'm well aware that I was here just the other day testifying on this same bill. I'll try to keep it brief. I am here to speak on behalf of the Dash 13 amendments. And I, even though the legislators that testified earlier indicated that they support the Dash 12s, I wanted to thank Senator Devlin and his office for their courtesy in getting this drafted so we could at least present it to you. As I stated in the earlier hearing on this bill last week, Metro has responsibilities for solid waste management in the Portland metropolitan region, and we would prefer guidelines rather than restrictions and requirements in how we implement those, that responsibility or carry out that responsibility. But we understand the desire to address this particular situation through this legislation. So, as I also explained last week, we support the underlying legislation. We're neutral on the Dash 12 and what Representative Parrish and Senator Devlin are trying to accomplish. And I want to say also, to be clear, we're not implying or suggesting any kind of judgment either way with respect to the particular facility, and I want to make that clear on the record just because, as I testified the other day, there's been a pre-application conference. Who knows what happens with this bill, if there could still be an application coming to us, and we have not made any judgment, of course, on an application that has not yet come to us. Our main concern with respect to the legislation is just to limit the effect of the amendment to the site in question or to the situation that it's intended to address. We're attempting, as I said, to retain our current authority and discretion with respect to other possible future applications of this statute and to avoid unintended consequences. We haven't been able in the time we've had to map all the possible places that this legislation could apply, all the exception land throughout the whole metropolitan area designated for rural residential use that might be within 1,500 feet of a school. We just don't know where that is right now. And so the intent of the Dash 13 amendment is to just narrow the effect of the Dash 12. The only difference between the Dash 12 and the Dash 13 is that under both the DEQ language and the Metro language, there's identical verbiage. It's easiest to look at on page 4, just on the back page, indicating that the amendment doesn't apply to disposal sites that are entirely enclosed, including where the feedstock is brought into the facility, in a permanent building. And the intent there is to address anaerobic digesters primarily. Basically, that's not what's being proposed at this site. And while we may or may not approve any given license application for an anaerobic digester, that's currently something that's within our responsibility and our discretion, and we just as soon keep it that way. However, I understand, I think I can see which way the wind is blowing on this legislation, and so I just wanted to make sure that you understood our concerns, and be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
I don't feel a breeze up here.
Maybe I'm premature in my weather forecast here.
Thank you. Thanks for coming back. Anybody else that wanted to testify that's not on the list on Senate Bill 462? Great. So we're going to close the public hearing on 462.
Carry over.
Excuse me. We're going to carry over the public hearing on 462, and we are now going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 841.
Person who wants to testify by phone.
Okay.
So I've got his phone number. He's just going to listen until we decide.
Is he dialed in? You want to dial in?
No, it's not. Okay. Because he said he would just want to tell me what he probably want to do. I don't know, Senator Roland.
Okay, Senator Roland here.
I'm not sure they were going to testify. Did they
tell
you?
Well, he did, but he had to finish another hearing, but he only had one bill and thought he would be here by now.
Okay.
And he's obviously not here yet.
Representative, you want to testify, right?
Do you want me to testify to your bill?
Do I testify to the bill?
No, not particularly. It's not my bill. I'm going to be reviewing amendments.
I did contact Representative Brzezinski, but
we may have Senator Roblin show up, and then we'll just
I just refer to him. Testimony we'll just go, from the Wine Association.
We're just going to go down the list, and
this is another.
There's
one.
A lot of people here, so I want to make sure those that have traveled over 100 miles, we get you in first.
Make sure Dan German's last.
Yeah,
I have. Dan German says he traveled over 100 miles.
Running in place
does
not turn.
Just check the wrong box. So it doesn't look like we have anybody that's over 100 miles today.
Probably this is just also another spreadsheet because it's another.
I feel like I drove 100 miles. I was up in Wilsonville. Okay, so why don't we just.
Thank you for doing this.
Go. We have a panel. Let's go ahead. Lee Bartholomew, Harry Peterson Nedry. And, the other guy, Dan German.
Yeah.
If you notice, the tie I have on today is a certain day again. Representative.
Thank you.
Representative, you have another chance today, by the way.
Oh, good.
Civil War Day.
Yeah.
It's rained out?
No. Well.
You're not doing that.
Thank you. Whoever wants to go ahead and go first, and you can just identify yourself for the record.
I'll go first. Thank you. Chair Cameron and members of the committee, I'm Lee Bartholomew, president of the Oregon Wine Growers Association. I'm also director of vineyard operations at Archery Summit Winery in the North Willamette Valley and co-owner of Dominio 4 Wines in the Columbia Gorge. So I'm here to ask your support for Senate Bill 841. The bill before you is the culmination of years' worth of work by the Oregon wine industry and key stakeholders to forge a consensus policy on the rules governing commercial activities and events at wineries on EFU land. We have had legislation over the last few sessions that have made incremental changes, but the bill before you today gives needed clarification and direction to wineries and public agencies that have grappled with balancing protection of farmland with the need for economic tools to make a winery successful. We believe the legislation gives certainty to wineries that wish to do commercial events on farmlands and at the same time emphasizes the primary purpose of winery activities, which is making quality wine. We don't support event centers at wineries on farmland, and this legislation ensures special events stay secondary to winemaking. We're proud to say that we have Oregon wine industry consensus on the bill before you today, something we've been without over the last several years, and we worked hard to achieve this. We're proud of ourselves. In fact, this legislation is born out of a work group organized by the governor's office, and that included stakeholders from state agencies, counties, the Oregon Farm Bureau, 1,000 Friends of Oregon, the Willamette Valley Wineries Association, and the OWA. We believe the collaborative approach has helped to improve the legislation, has set the stage for good working relationships and ongoing dialogue moving forward. We've worked hard to forge this consensus. And prior to the work group, we surveyed our members twice. We conducted town hall meetings in all of Oregon's wine regions, and we met for months to work on this important bill. From the wine industry's perspective, this legislation has important provisions that have been unclear since the permitted use winery statute was written in 1989. Many of these provisions in Senate Bill 841 are landmark in the sense that wineries are provided more certainty in the future, especially when developing business plans that rely on commercial activities and events to market and promote a winery, while doing some special events to diversify a winery's income. This consensus bill balances the need to preserve Oregon's farmland with the economic realities of running a successful winery in a competitive marketplace. We believe this bill strikes a balance. That's all.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. You want to go ahead and have the whole panel, and then if we have some questions.
Certainly. Vice Chair Cameron, members of the committee. I'm Harry Peterson Nedry. I'm currently the president of the Willamette Valley Wineries Association and also founder and co-owner of Shehalem Winery in the Willamette Valley. The Willamette Valley Wineries Association is the marketing, tourism, and advocacy arm of those wineries that are based in the Willamette Valley. The Willamette Valley being the viticultural area federally designated in which more than two-thirds of Oregon's wineries are located. I'm a semi-pioneer, not as much of a pioneer as Dick Ponzi behind me or Pat Dudley, but close. And I've seen major growth and changes in the industry over the years, 33 years of them. As Lee's indicated, we've grown to contribute a lot to the economy. I think it's just short of $3 billion annually. And part of what we've contributed is not just dollars, but a great deal of cachet and a high quality reputation, not only nationally, but worldwide for the state. The Willamette Valley Wineries Association has worked vigorously with the OWA and others to create this industry bill, and we think it addresses the key concerns of the industry and represents pretty fairly the entire state in this process. Many facets of the bill clarify and define precisely the reality of making and marketing wine in the state today, as well as providing a new business, set of new business opportunities going forward. All of this while, and this is most important, preserving a careful stewardship of the Oregon farmland that ultimately is the key factor in our success as an industry. This bill balances the needs of the state, as far as we're concerned. Intentionally, some provisions are different between regions, and that is a general awareness that one size does not necessarily fit all. And the specific example of that in this bill is the special events provisions. Those special events protections are slightly different as you leave the Willamette Valley and proceed to around the rest of the state. Within the Willamette Valley, the provisions permit special events, but with safeguards. Those safeguards allow for greater oversight than the rest of the state, and this is a recognition that the winery and vineyard densities of the Willamette Valley specifically present unique pressures and opportunities that the other regions of the state don't feel yet. Since the steadily increasing value of the Willamette Valley brand is probably almost tantamount to what, say, Napa Valley is now, or at least was not too recently. It's critical that we maintain the focus that we've got, maintain the focus on the quality, not necessarily of special events happening that have nothing to do with wineries, but for the quality of farming quality and preservation of the rural environment that helps attract the high quality and high value customers, consumers of our wines in the state. We need to maintain the cool climate we've got. We need to maintain the soils that we have in the Willamette Valley and in Oregon in general. We need to also, within the Willamette Valley specifically, we're talking now, we need to maintain the Willamette Valley brand, and that means the boundaries that are federally designated for this AVA or American Viticultural Area. We also have a united stance, and as a whole, the wine industry, the wine community, has an approach to marketing and natural resource preservation that is the key to our success, and we ourselves going forward have a good view as to what the vision should be for both the commercial side and also the preservation side of this great natural resource that we've got. We think the wine industry is a great, strong engine of economic growth, and this is the way we're going to continue it. We're proud of our industry, and we anticipate continued economic growth so long as we're careful in maintaining the boundaries between commerce, especially those activities not related to making, growing, and marketing wine, and farmland preservation. With the projection of another 1.5 million people in Oregon between now and 2050, we think it becomes critical that we maintain our whole state and long-term visionary perspective, both in encouraging commerce and preserving these lands. Our wines are special because this place is special. We've crafted a consensus approach that's finely balanced, and we can't overemphasize this. We worked long and hard for this balance. We appreciate your support in maintaining that balance and moving our industry forward with a single voice. We ask that the legislature enact this legislation as it's proposed by the wine community. Thanks, and I'm open for answering any questions.
Thank you. We're going to go ahead and... Go ahead, and then he's acknowledging you first. Okay, great. He didn't want to hear your testimony.
I was going to say nice things. Vice Chair Cameron, Vice Chair Frederick, and members of the committee, I'm Dan Jarman, representing the Oregon Wine Growers Association. Thank you very much for hearing this bill. I wanted to actually thank Senator Roblin for shepherding this bill through the Senate for us, and other members of the work group organized by the governor's office, Richard Whitman and the governor's office, who you're going to hear from very soon. We have just a great deal of appreciation and thanks for the stakeholders that worked with us for months and many meetings, hours of meetings, to really get to this consensus piece of legislation. In particular, the counties, Mike Eliason with the county, Mike Brandt with Yamhill County is here today. I'm very grateful for all the work he put in, especially trying to define marketing events, along with the Oregon Farm Bureau and the Thousand Friends of Oregon. It really was a fine collaborative effort and has produced a very good piece of legislation. I just wanted to mention that we're going to have some amendments. The bill that came from the Senate needed some additional work. We all recognize that. Two provisions you'll see contained in the Dash 13 and Dash 14 amendments. One has to deal with bed and breakfasts. We've tightened up the language related to that to ensure that the second meal served at a bed and breakfast would only be for those registered guests, the bed and breakfast. The language that came out of the Senate was a little loose, so we think this is a needed clarification. We'd ask you to support that. The second has to deal with a conditional use pathway for wineries outside of the permitted use winery statute rules. Many wineries are cited under the conditional use category, commercial activities in conjunction with farm use, and the rules for this category have been developed by the courts, most recently in a case, the Friends of Yamhill Yamhill County versus Yamhill County case. The Dash 13 and 14 amendments clarify that the standards developed by the courts for conditional use wineries will continue to apply. The only change in Senate Bill 841 the only change that you'll find in 841 as it relates to conditional use wineries applies the 25% income limitation to those wineries that are cited under a conditional use process. We think that's very important. If you're going to require conditional use wineries to adhere to the 25% income limitation, that should apply to CUP wineries as well. So we believe this limitation is appropriate to ensure that non-wine income remains incidental to wine production and wine sales at wineries on farmland. You'll see some other amendments, the wine industry, the Oregon Wine Growers Association, the Willamette Valley Wineries Association, the other wine regions would be opposed to those amendments. We're supportive of Dash 13 and Dash 14. I wanted to get that on the record before a work session may occur on this bill. And then finally, later you'll hear from some folks providing testimony on a situation in Washington County where there is a vineyard that for a number of years has been doing several commercial activities, weddings in particular. I just wanted to let you know that that situation has nothing to do with this piece of legislation. The permitted use winery statute that we're amending with Senate Bill 841 is only for wineries that fit under the permitted use winery definition. The situation you'll hear about later is a vineyard that is not a winery. This legislation does not apply to that situation. The legislature in 2011 passed a bill, Senate Bill 960, that governs commercial activities and events on ag land that is not wineries. You have legislation in place that, if Washington County chose to pursue that legislation, would give that county the tools to address some of the issues that you're going to hear later on. So I just want to make that very clear. We appreciate the situation that the folks are going to discuss later on. It is a challenge for them, but Washington County has the tools to address that situation today if they choose to. So thank you very much for hearing from us. We're happy to answer any questions appreciate your support of Senate Bill 841.
Any questions for the panel? Representative Holby.
Thank you. I appreciate you coming forward. So as I'm hearing it, you're supporting both the Dash 13 and the Dash 14 amendments. Can you tell me a little bit about the Dash 14 amendment that changes 215.452 sub 1 sub B?
I think that Vice Chair Cameron, Representative Holby, I think Richard Whitman in his testimony will cover that amendment. So.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
That's my question, too.
Okay, great. Okay. Well, we're going to have Mr. Whitman up right after we hear from the Senator, so that's okay with everybody. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. Thanks for your hard work. I did attend one of your events. I know how hard it was.
We drank wine afterwards. So
I wasn't there for that. Senator Roblin, would you like to come forward?
Welcome. Thank you very much. It's my first opportunity to be in front of this Land Use Committee. And Vice Chair Cameron, thank you, and committee members. For the record, Arnie Roblin, Senator from District 5, Oregon Coast, from Coos Bay to Tillamook Bay. You know, this is one of those bills that it's kind of like having been here for 8 years and looked at the land use stuff, and especially the things around wineries, and watching what Representative Holby had to go through in previous sessions, what Representative Clem had to do in previous sessions to try to get winery bills and winery things together. To me, when I ended up receiving the opportunity to work with this bill in the Senate, I thought, wow, miracles do happen. There are a group of people who came together, and I commend Mr. Whitman and the governor's staff for pulling together the work group that worked tirelessly. I thought I was going to have this bill fairly early in the session, but there was still work to be done, and they kept meeting. I went to one of their meetings here in the Capitol as we brought the people together to kind of fine-tune the last little bits of the winery bill. And I guess I'm excited because I do believe that this is that burgeoning industry that has really helped through the recession, helped Oregon. We continue to employ people. We continue to make a product which is becoming world-renowned more and more because of the conditions that we have here in Oregon. And the amazing people, the industry leaders who you're going to hear from today, some of whom you've already heard from, that decided to make this specialty wine area of the world. Having had the opportunity to visit some wineries in California when my son was getting married, before they got married, we had a large party and we got a bus and we went around part of the wine country in California and had a great opportunity to visit wineries, to have taste wine, have a little bit of food, and be a part of that tourist industry that I think is burgeoning in our state. But I've also been involved with agriculture for a long time, and one of the things that you have is these competing uses. And in the Willamette Valley in particular, we have a lot of other agriculture that's going on, and that means you move things around, you cause dust, you make other kinds of, you use roads in ways that most people don't want to have to deal with. They think that the I-5 is bad, but when you're moving equipment from one farm to another, it goes a lot slower than I-5, and people get frustrated on these little teeny roads. And these wineries are tucked away in all these different places, and yet to visit them is a special thing, and I want those opportunities to happen in Oregon. So I'm really happy to support Senate Bill 841. It comes to you with from the Rural Communities Senate, Rural Communities and Economic Development Committee, and it passed unanimously there. For many years, Oregon's wine industry and policymakers have grappled with finding a consensus policy on the rules governing the commercial activities and events in wineries located in the FU lands. We have really been struggling to figure out what that looks like. And I do not believe that this will be the last bill that you'll hear about wineries and how we do things in Oregon with respect to our wineries. There will be things that come along as time goes on, and that's what it should be. I mean, the industry is growing. It's new places are happening. We have to grow with the times, and the legislation has to do the same thing. But this legislation, as I said before, comes from a work group that the governor's office put together, and it included wine industry representatives, state agencies, counties, land use stakeholders. All of them got together and did the miraculous thing, came together on a policy that they could bring to the legislator. The wine industry will argue, and the Senate agrees, that this bill balances protection of farmland with the need for economic tools to make the wineries successful. And that's our goal. I mean, it's not the end-all, but it is to continue the success that we've already begun. Now, this bill has many important provisions that seek to clarify the statutes governing permitted-use wineries. And just a few of those important provisions. Better defining of what is marketing, event in a winery where the primary purpose is promoting and selling of wineries quality wines. That's not even listed in that group of, you know, 6 or 18 or whatever number of events you can have. Those are events that are just about selling wine. That's part of what you do on the business. So they aren't included. And it used to be that we had, those were listed as special activities. Placing adequate sideboards around winery special events on farmland where marketing or promoting of winery is secondary. And making sure that we always think of it as secondary. It is the production of wine that is the primary use. And clarifying food service and kitchen facilities in wineries that allows pairing of foods with wines. And again, whenever you want to have a great wine, you want to have the paired food that goes with it. But we aren't making restaurants out in the FU lands. We're making opportunities for people to have those pairings. Some of you might argue that the bill needs some major changes. I don't agree with that. I support the amendments suggested by the wine industry and the governor's office and hope that you will adopt those good clarifying ones. And you're going to hear more about those later. With those changes, this consensus bill balances the need to preserve Oregon's farmland with the economic realities of running a successful winery in a competitive marketplace. And I applaud the wine industry and the stakeholders for working tirelessly to find consensus. And it was halfway through the session that they finally came up with the bill that we could actually have today. And I hope that you will respect that consensus, which has produced a good piece of legislation. I will continue my services in the legislature and always be ready to continue to work with this great industry and trying to figure out what's the best as time goes on and to make sure that the wineries that exist are successful and continue to provide the jobs and the exceptional wine for our state and the nation. And I ask you to support Senate Bill 841. And I thank you, and I look forward to any questions you might have. And I appreciate the efforts that a lot of people have put in to get us to this point.
questions for Senator Roblin? Senator, I wanted to thank you. I just want to make sure you know you were recognized by Dan Jarman while you were getting your extra piece of paper. He thanked you for
that's nice,
all the work
thing.
You've done on this. But you said this wouldn't be the last bill. I think.
Yeah, I wish it were. I wish I could say that we have the perfect bill for all time. But you know, our industry is going to grow. It's going to do other kinds of things. You're going to find other wineries that, you know, grow and grow and grow, and new properties that have gone. And we'll have to look at some things. I think you're going to hear from Mr. Ponzi about issues that maybe we still need to look at with respect to the size of the vineyards and where they are and how you combine them to make the kind of things that we want. So there's lots of things that I think give us opportunity in the future. But right now, we're trying to figure out how do we grow into this new place. At the same time, we keep the playing field for a lot of our other people that are out there farming and doing other kinds of things in the same areas of the state. And how do we make that all kind of work together? And I think this is a bill that does that.
Well, thank you. But Representative Davis has already filed the Super Growler bill, so that's coming next.
That would
session.
Be good. Yeah.
Is that just called a keg?
Yeah. And okay. You know, yeah, that would be a really good thing.
Last thing before I let you go, you said whenever you have good wine, you need good food. I would, that's as right. A restaurant guy, I think it's the opposite.
Really?
Whenever you have
surprising.
Good food, you need good wine.
I can't believe you would say that.
Thank you. All right. Thank you
thank
very much.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Whitman, you want to come up and present all the technical stuff for us? Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Cameron, members of the committee. For the record, Richard Whitman, Governor Kitzhaber's Natural Resource Advisor. Here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 841 with the -13 or -14 amendments. This has been a long road, and it did not really start with this session. It started back, as some of you know, in 2011, even before. But I briefly want to take the privilege of repeating some of that history for those of you who don't know it, because it's important to some of the testimony I think you're going to hear later today. The Association of Oregon Counties in 2010 convened a task force to look at this evolving issue of events on farmland. The weddings, the other types of events on farmland has become more and more contentious around the state over the last 5 years or so. And AOC really did a great job of putting together a very broad work group that met for, I believe, over a year, chaired by Commissioner Stern from Yamhill County, that came up with what became Senate Bill 960, enacted by this legislature in 2011. And that set up a general framework for counties at their option to adopt ordinances that allow special events on farmland, but with controls that were acceptable both to parts of the agricultural industry that are interested in that and some of the more traditional production ag industry that was concerned about conflict. So very delicate balancing job there. At the same time, we had this really same discussion going on with a subpart of the agricultural industry, which is also evolving very quickly, wineries. And wineries, as you've heard, are becoming more and more dependent on sales at wineries, and as part of that, having events where they are able to market their wine. So that resulted in a rather difficult road to what became House Bill 3280 in 2011 that at least temporarily set up a way for wineries to have special events. That bill did not deal with some of the fundamental issues of what is a winery and what should be allowed as a matter of course at a winery. And as a result, the governor was asked to convene a work group. We didn't volunteer for this, but we agreed to do it because we thought it was important. But we were asked to convene a work group, and we did. And that, as you've heard, that work group met repeatedly and dealt with not just the events issue, but also the question of what are some of the normal daily activities that should be part of the permitted use at a winery. And so that resulted in Senate Bill 841, which you have before you today. There have been some amendments proposed from the Angross version of 841. The main amendments are two in the dash 14s. Just very briefly, first of all, to deal with an issue that came up late in the discussions of the work group, the question of a winery that has some lands, vineyards contiguous to where the winery is, but also may have land scattered about in an area around the winery, not necessarily contiguous. And there was a desire on the part of the Wine Growers Association to allow that as part of the permitted use winery bill. We don't have any policy concerns with that. We think it's consistent with the general thrust of the legislation. The second piece was a narrowing in the Angrost version, and I testified to this over in Senator Roblin's committee on the Senate side. The bed and breakfast provisions that came out of legislative council were pretty broad, and broader than I think was intended by anybody who submitted the amendment. So there was an agreement to tighten those up. Those have been tightened up in the dash 13s and 14s and are before you now. So do we believe this is the end of the story? We don't. I agree with Senator Roblin that this issue is going to continue to evolve in the state, and there will likely be need for future legislation. Certainly in other parts of the country where the wine industry is important, we've seen that. The Department of Land Conservation and Development has recently done a study looking at some of those other areas and the issues that have arisen in other areas. And I think as this industry matures in Oregon, we're going to see a need to continue to adapt our framework. As we get an increasing density, we're going to get more conflicts, and we're going to have to come back and look at some of those issues more carefully. For right now, we believe that Senate Bill 841 is a good step forward. Does it resolve all the issues? No, it doesn't, but the governor is supportive of 841, and we'd ask your support for the bill as well. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
No questions.
Oh, Representative Holby.
Thanks. Rick, thank you, Ms. Chair and Mr. Whitman, and appreciate your volunteering to keep working on this issue. I know it's been a long road for you. So I know that you're supportive of the A13s, I think you said, and the A14s.
Yes.
But I think you said or. Mm-hmm. And so are they exclusive of each other, or could they both be adopted?
Chair Cameron, Representative Holvey, I believe the A14s adds provisions to the A13s. That was my understanding. But I'm frankly recently in from Klamath Falls and haven't had a chance to look at the A13s carefully. I can tell you definitively the A14s are fine with us. Mm. My understanding was the A14s added in provisions in addition to the 13s. I believe the 13s right. Dealt only with the bed and breakfast issue.
So, okay, I thought that they had something to do with the food and beverage at charitable events, too. Was that also in the A14?
Here's, make a suggestion. I know Len put together a little chart here that summarized some of the changes, and I don't know if, Richard, if you've had a chance to look at
that. I have not.
That's okay. I don't need an answer to that one, but if I may, another question.
Sure.
The one provision that I was curious about, because I'm trying to remember the original legislation and what difference this really makes or doesn't make, was the one that allows for the permitted use of a winery on site. Of a 15-acre vineyard, with an on-site 15-acre vineyard that's on 40 acres, and that they would also plus have land that's not contiguous but within 15 miles of the winery site. And I believe originally the second 40 acres was contiguous to the first 40 acres, and the reason for that was for different uses, I guess. And I'm not sure if those uses still, different uses exist between a winery that's less than 50,000 gallons is and on 15 acres as opposed to more than 50,000 gallons that's on 40 acres. So I was trying to discern that difference, and that's been changed. So I was wondering if you could explain that to me.
Chair Cameron, Representative Holvey, I'll try. This gets fairly technical. You also have Mike Giardi, attorney representing the Wine Growers Association here today, who could probably answer some of these technical questions if we really get down into the weeds. But very briefly, under the ANGROS version of Senate Bill 841, we have two categories of permitted use wineries, the less than 50,000 gallon wineries, and those wineries have to have an on-site vineyard of 15 acres, a contiguous vineyard of 15 acres, or have a long-term contract for the purchase of grapes from at least 15 acres of a contiguous vineyard. So in all cases, we're talking about 15 acres contiguous to the winery. For the larger wineries, at least 50,000 gallons, that's where you get the vineyard having to be at least 40 acres on site or 40 acres contiguous. Or a long-term contract for 40 acres. So that's the sort of base provisions. Then if you go to the A14s, starting on line 3 of the A14s, this would basically add another category of permitted use wineries, which would own an on-site vineyard of at least 15 acres on a tract of 40 acres and own at least 40 additional acres of vineyard that are located within 15 miles. So this is to deal with the situation, if I remember correctly, this is the larger wineries, where you've got basically the vineyard is split up into a couple of different holdings, at least some of which is not contiguous with the winery. You know, the general thrust of the permitted use winery legislation has been to have the winery and the vineyard be essentially in the same place. This would open it up a little bit. And again, I talked about the evolving wine industry. Some of the vineyard would have to be contiguous, but this would allow some to be non-contiguous within a 15-mile radius.
Thank you. A follow-up?
Yeah. Sure.
And I understand that piece, and I remember the reason for making things contiguous. But so, what is the under 841 or current statute? What is the different allowable uses for the wineries that are allowed on a 15-acre site versus a 40-acre site?
Chair Cameron, Representative Holvey, there's no difference under 841. The uses that are allowed are the same, and those appear in Section 2, Sub 2B, which starts on line 14 of page 2 of the engrossed bill. Those are really what I would call the core use provisions of the winery. In addition to making wine and marketing and selling wine, that list a series of activities that are allowed on both the smaller wineries and the larger wineries.
That's what I was trying to get at. So the uses allowed on the 15-acre are the same.
Yes.
As the 40-acre. That's what I was trying to remember. So thanks for helping me refresh my memory on that.
Good.
And one other question, and maybe you're not the right one to ask this question, but I'm going to ask it of you anyway, since you're there. The other issue that, you know, I have been struggling with was the special events, the permits for events number, 7 through 18, mm-hmm. and how that's not uniform across the state. And so that was something that concerned me to start with, and recognizing that there are density issues in the Willamette Valley, and that we did hear, you know, about going back to 3280. We heard, you know, issues around that problem with event centers as such that may be under 9C or under conditional use permits, maybe. But the way this was addressed was to carve out the whole Willamette Valley and require that special permitting for the special events versus the rest of the state. And I guess my concern with that was that though I've heard of some concerns from Washington and Yamhill counties on those sorts of issues, I didn't really hear those same concerns, very many concerns mm-hmm. south of there, where there were complaints that were being registered with the counties on that. And so I was wondering why we would go forward and solve that particular problem that doesn't yet exist. I mean, if we were going to do that, why wouldn't we do that statewide and say, oh, we're going to have those problems everywhere? As you know, I'm just questioning the bifurcation of the Willamette Valley from the whole state, and then bifurcating the, you know, why wouldn't we just bifurcate where the complaints and the issues were coming from and address the that issue in the future if it becomes an issue at that time?
Chair Cameron, Representative Holvey, I appreciate the question and the opportunity to answer it because I know this is one of the core issues that's important to you. I think there are a couple of answers to that. One is there's some precedent for treating the Willamette Valley separately from the rest of the state in land use terms. This wouldn't be the first time that the legislature has chosen to do that. More fundamentally, once you start to break down the Willamette Valley into sub-areas, you quickly get into a discussion of why not do this on a county-by-county basis. Mm-hmm. And we, frankly, chased our tails in the work group on that issue extensively. The whole question of doing this at the state level versus doing it at the county level is a very difficult balance. Industry, some parts of industry will express a desire to do it on a more localized, even a county by county basis. Other parts of industry, probably more, the weight of the industry, and they may want to speak to this themselves, seem to want a, quote, level playing field. And so that issue of level playing field is, I think, a major part of trying to at least deal with the Willamette Valley in a uniform manner. There's also an equity issue here, and you're going to hear about parity, I think, from some of the other folks who want to testify on this bill. Parity between wineries and other farm uses in terms of events. I mentioned 960. 960 allows up to 18 events on just regular farm use land. For counties that have adopted and implemented that provision. And it also, although the provisions are not exactly the same, sets up a gradated system so as you have more and more events, there's more opportunity for review. And for speaking now for the governor and the governor's office in terms of the policy, having the higher level of scrutiny for once you go over six events, we believe is warranted just because of the potential for conflicts once you get beyond six events. And the permitting process that's been set up for that 7 to 18 events is set up to be streamlined. It's not that difficult, but it is something that if there are problems after 5 years, there's some ability to go back and fix things. So we believe that's important from a policy sense also. So a variety of different reasons. Fundamentally, just keeping this all together, frankly.
Good. Great. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you for your hard work over the years.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you.
They started this process.
Interesting. The 10th anniversary of Tremeca the Northwest Viticulture Center's celebration just popped up on my calendar while we're sitting here listening to the wine bill. So we could be drinking wine there at 4:30 to 7 o'clock, or we could do this.
We're going to do this.
So this meeting is adjourned?
No. We're going to do this until we're done. We need to get this bill heard out. So the next person on our list today is Bill Perry.
Thank you, Chair Cameron. Members of the committee, Bill Perry for the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association. I was specifically involved in one piece of this. I will say I was invited to the process. I will echo the comments you heard before. It was a very extensive process with town halls and everything else, and I attended many of those, and I think they did a good job trying to get all consensus as much as they could. So I think it was a very, very good process, so I want to state that for the record. The piece that I dealt with was on the bed and breakfast that you've heard about a couple of times. It's page 4, section 13. Specifically, if you have a bed and breakfast in a outside the urban growth boundary, you're limited to 9 rooms, and by statute, you're limited to only serving breakfast. The conflict came in these that are wineries and in wine country. Obviously, we had several guests that were returning after being out participating in many of these activities, and they wanted something to eat, and they were basically prevented by law from serving them an additional meal. So what we're trying to do is, when it's affiliated with alcohol, be able to make sure that there is food that's able to be served. So there's not very many of these that are wineries in conjunction with bed and breakfast, so it's a small audience. The original bill, obviously Legislative Council came up with the language. It satisfied our issue. Both the 13s and the 14s address the issue sufficiently, so from the concerns of what we were trying to achieve out of this bill, any of those options achieve it, and so whatever the committee feels most comfortable with, we're okay with. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions and let you try to make your wine tastings.
Any questions? I just have one. Is it good food with good wine, or good wine with good food?
In your establishment, it was always good food, and I'll state that for the record.
Stephen Cafori. Oh, and Ron Ebert together.
And he's on the phone, so I'll call him.
We're going to call Ron on the phone.
Ron, hi there. It's Lynn Beaton. You're now hooked into the hearing. Welcome.
Hello, Ron. This is Representative Kevin Cameron, and you're going to be on a panel testifying here with Mr. Cafori. So who would like to go first?
Let me do the introduction, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
My name is Stephen Cafori. I'm here representing the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. We've introduced the -9 amendments, and I'd like to introduce Ron Eber, who was recently retired from DLCD. He was one of the originals back in the old days when the bill was first passed, and has been a stalwart in that agency for years, specializing in farm issues. And I don't think there's anybody in the state who knows more about the issues of farm use, farm deferral, farm conflicts with non-farm uses on farmland. And so I'd like to pass the microphone figuratively to Ron Eber.
Mr. Eber, you are on the phone, and we're here to hear your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate this special opportunity to speak on behalf of the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association about Senate Bill 841. I would say there are some good provisions in this bill.
Mr. Eber, Mr. Eber, just for the record, can you just go ahead and identify yourself?
My name is Ron Eber, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association.
Thank you.
And as Mr. Cafori pointed out, before I retired, I was the agricultural land specialist for the Department of DLCD and have worked on this issue and these issues in EFU zones for well over 30 years.
Thank you.
The focus of, and our amendments are the -9, the A9s. The real issue to us, the red line issue, is that we're talking about parity and fairness. We believe that we're focusing on the agrotourism and other commercial events that are secondary, where wine sales are secondary. We're not talking about the direct marketing stuff. We think that those events should be treated the same whether they're at a winery or at another farm. Similar events should be subject to the same review process and standards. And so our approach in the A9s was to subject those activities to the provisions that were passed last session that Mr. Whitman referred to from Senate Bill 960. And then that way, there's some parity. We do not see why one farm or farm stand is subject to a different set of review procedures or standards than the same events when they go on at a winery. To do that, we have proposed several things because those provisions in 960 require the events to be incidental and subordinate to winery activity or the farm activity. We would propose removing the 25% cap that's currently in the bill as it applies to agritourism events. It's an unenforceable provision. It's unwieldy. It puts wineries in the position of having to put out proprietary information, and it puts counties in a very awkward position of trying to review information they're really not familiar with. And we think the provisions in 960 would do a much better job and take the confusion out of that. We would only leave the 25% cap as it applies to the items sold, say, at the gift shop at the winery. That 25% cap originally was developed for farm stands back, I think, in 1993, so that planters and counties could kind of eyeball the range of things being sold at a farm stand to keep it proportional and so the tail wasn't wagging the dog. It works in that context. It really, when you get into the myriad of agritourism activities, it becomes unwieldy. Secondly, we also are proposing that, you know, when you shift over to 960 provisions, actually the wineries would get some more events of up to 72 hours rather than just 18 days of events. So there's a trade-off here. But again, the point is parity and fairness. If we have use or activity, it ought to be reviewed under the same provisions and standards. And a major concern to us is that it's not clear how the agrotourism or other commercial activities are being reviewed at all outside the valley, and it appears inside the valley, at least the intent of the bill, is that up to six events are exempt. There's no notice. There's no opportunity for hearing. It's just between the county and the winery to do these type of events. There's no limits on size or scale, and whether the counties can condition these is totally optional. And this we feel is a major concern, that the wineries will get to conduct these kinds of activities basically on their own, not subject to review, without neighbors getting notice. Whereas if they were to go forward at any other farm in a farm zone, it could even be on a property right next door to a winery, they would have to go through an extensive review, and we see this as a major problem. Other amendments in the Dash 9s are basically for conformance purposes, and we tried to rewrite the activities that we feel are permitted as part of any winery to be a little clearer and take out any generalities, because we fear that to avoid the review provisions for agritourism activities, they will be put through as and called marketing activities. The final point I'd like to make, or at least ask that it get clarified, is what we call the Blueberry Cafe Amendment. We have proposed in the Dash 9s that when you're dealing with the B&Bs, it had said that where a B&B is cited as a home occupation, that you can serve some meals. And there's not a problem with that, but in an exclusive farm use zone, a home occupation has to get a land use approval under ORS 215-448. And without that statutory reference, you could end up with a situation where the B&B may feel, because they've got a license from the health division, they can proceed with having the B&B without getting the land use approval. So I think Mr. Whitman's amendments, the dash 13s, are an improvement on the A bill, but it should at least be clarified that because it says as cited as a home occupation, and because those amendments are in Chapter 215, that therefore the land use approval that Chapter 215 requires for such things in an EFU zone is applicable. And you could either do that on the record, or if you added in the dash 13 on the first page after line 8, after home occupation, it just said under ORS 215-448, and the same thing on the second page on line 2, I think that would be clarified, and you wouldn't run into the problem where someone proceeds and then there's an oops, which was the problem with the Blueberry Cafe many years ago. With that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I will conclude. That's the thrust of our amendments, is parity and fairness, that agritourism and other commercial activities be reviewed the same or under similar standards in both at wineries and on other lands in an EFU zone. And if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer.
Any questions for Mr. Eber? Representative Holvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Eber, Representative Holvey. So I can understand exactly what you're saying, I think, and it sounds like to me that you're saying for parity in exclusive farm lands that wineries be treated the same as any other type of farming operation. Is that sort of the gist of it? And if they want to have special activities, they go through the conditional use permit system, and for the home occupation, they use 448, which is open to other farmland operations besides wineries as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holden, that's basically what we're saying, is that if you're going to allow agritourism and other commercial activities that are not for the primary purpose of promoting the sale of wine, those marketing activities are permitted outright in the winery, then there's no reason that we can see that those activities in the winery should be permitted on different standards and without any land use review process than on a property right next door where there's an orchard. They would have to go through a different process.
Follow-up, Ms. Quick.
Yes.
So I think that ultimately you're questioning the existence of 215-452, which recognizes a special place in statutes for wineries to start with. And I'm not sure how far back that history goes, but it was something that was put in as a policy for, in the legislature, I believe at least, I won't guess how many years ago, but quite some time ago, that just recognized that the wineries did attract a different business model than a wheat farm, for example, or most other types of agriculture. I mean, historically, people have gone to wineries to taste the wine and the wares of that, and I think the legislature recognized that they were different and needed a different set of statutes. So I'm guessing you disagree with that assumption.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holt, I do not. The provision for wineries under ORS 452, 215-452, was done in 1989, because prior to that time, wineries were only approved under the provisions for commercial activities in conjunction with farm use. And the recognition at that time was, if we think wineries are, and there was a lot of litigation over whether that other provision allowed wineries, the consensus at the time, led by the department, was, if we think wineries are a great idea and appropriate in a farm zone, then let's just say so. And so working with the Winery Association, we created 215-452, which was kind of a quick way to set some clear standards for wineries to come in, and if they did, then they wouldn't be subject to review by the counties to add additional standards. And so that's why that was in there. So, no, I think 452 is an appropriate way to go. If I had my druthers, 452 would be the only way to approve wineries. And the add-on way to go for commercial activities in conjunction with farmeries really is unnecessary.
Well, thank you for clarifying your position.
Good. Okay. Any other questions?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Eber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Our next individual, Linda DeBoer. Did I get that right?
Correct. And Deborah.
Lockwood together.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Come on up. Welcome, and whoever would like to go first, just identify yourself.
Thank you. I will. I'm Linda DeBoer from Hillsboro, Oregon. Chair Cameron and committee. As neighbors of a winery and potential and would-be wineries, we are stakeholders in SB 841. One of those, the would-be winery, was mentioned earlier in testimony by Dan Jarman, but there are others. Even the would-be winery offers a valuable cautionary tale, as that vineyard applied to be a winery under Senate Bill 1055, which was passed in the special session in 2010, and was not really referred to in the history by Mr. Whitman, but there was a similar bill, SB 1055, which has now had ripples, and that should be considered in considering this bill. During the last few years, our neighborhood has had considerable experience with property owners who have sought to legitimize their event businesses through applications for wineries, farm stands, or a private park. We have been involved in Washington County land use hearings and LUBA hearings, and we have been a part of the difficult enforcement procedures of regulating events on rural properties. With this experience, we can spot several red flags in SB 841 that signal unintended consequences, difficulties in enforcement, and more legal confusion. We also see an increased burden being placed on neighbors for enforcement, and this yoke is already too heavy in our county's complaint-based systems. One area in the bill that needs to be examined more closely is the 25-75 proportional income test. The application of that test in two Washington County hearings was discussed at length by hearings officers, the hearings officer, and those portions of the 2010 decisions are attached with this testimony, and you have those with you there. SB 841, however, seems to revert to the version of the 25-75 income test that was written for farm stands several years before. This interpretation is not useful when attempting to regulate events. SB 841 states that third-party revenues need not be counted in the non-wine portion of the income test. That leaves out most of the non-wine revenues associated with an event, as most wineries outsource these services, including catering, dance bands, DJs, or other entertainment. The exclusion of third-party revenues makes this income test useless, and descriptions of this bill cannot rightfully claim that events need to be ancillary and supportive of the wine business. We also know that the definitions of promotional and charitable can be stretched to include almost any event, and we have that from experience in this enforcement period since 2010's SB 1055. This bill has some complicated formulas for so-called regulation of the numbers of vaguely defined events, but it does not deal with many concerns of neighbors. One of these is the size of events. Rural roads and rural activities are greatly impacted by the influx of abnormal amounts of traffic on small and unsuitable roads. Another problem faced by neighbors is sound pollution, especially from amplified sound. Think of a loudly amplified dance band with speakers pointing out towards your neighborhood on what should be a quiet summer evening. Continued outdoor amplification by a business is not acceptable in city or suburban neighborhoods, and it should not be in a rural neighborhood either. Please remember that any of the unlimited promotional events could include amplified music in this bill. With crowds and traffic and amplified music not even dealt with in this bill, it is certainly not a bill that has the consensus of neighborhood stakeholders. We are not trying to imply that all wineries will want to bend the rules and annoy their neighborhoods and neighbors. We have met some fine winery owners the last few years who share our concerns about events at wineries. However, law should be written not to just enable the lawful, but to regulate potential offenders. And while these offenders are a minority of wine growers, they are a reality that must be regulated in a manner that does not further burden and endanger their neighbors. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And our last witness today.
Am I the last witness?
You are. Wrap it up.
Chair Cameron and members of the committee, I guess I'd like to say a word or two about my name is Deborah Lockwood. I'm from Hillsboro, Oregon. Making a distinction between a vineyard and a winery and whether that's relevant to this bill. The relevance is that we're talking about on-site wine sales. And that was exactly the activity that was occurring at the vineyard near us. Their grapes were grown there. The wine was made off-site, but then their label was put on it, came back to be sold at their very nice Tuscan-style home to the public who came to the vineyard. So my testimony is as follows. My context for SB 841 is a 15-acre vineyard near me that in the summers of 2011 and 2012 conducted promotional activities on a minimum of 4 days every week. The public was invited on-site to enjoy wine, food, and relaxation during music nights, movie nights, philanthropy nights, and Sunday open gardens. So the promotional activities were under the aegis of being a farm stand. That was the official label. It is a matter of semantics whether these were activities or events. The practical effects of traffic and noise in rural areas are the same. This type of schedule could occur at any Oregon winery under SB 841. Promotional activities form a large and loose category in the bill, ultimately including anything meant to feature the product. The only control of activities is a gross income ratio, which in effect requires that retail pricing of wine and non-wine items be adjusted so as to result in a lawful balance. Such an accounting exercise is remote from the real task of minimizing adverse impacts outside UGBs. With only the income ratio as a control, the activities section of this bill says to wineries, Do as you wish. Neither neighboring uses nor public safety are considered or protected while commerce is brought to the country. When wineries are located in farm or farm and forest zones, promotional activities must have reasonable limits. Size and frequency, duration, and noise must be within bounds so as not to disrupt other rural uses. If including and specifying limits in the bill is beyond possibility at this point, I suggest something very straightforward. Scrap the income ratio and the certified audit for promotional activities. In its place, require a simple log be kept of promotional activities at a winery that invite the public on site. What date, roughly how many people, such that counties and citizens can at least be informed going forward as to the dimensions of this aspect of winery operations, an aspect that can be very close in all but name to agritourism and events. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
So one quick comment. I've been talking to Linda and Deborah a little bit. They're out in my neck of the woods, as you might see there. And the one thing I'll say is that the vineyard that they're talking about is kind of a notorious bad actor in this whole discussion. And I actually am optimistic that the county is stepping in and being more aggressive to address some of the concerns that you raise. And I hope that county action will prove that what the assertion of the wine industry makes is true, which is that when you actually distinguish between a winery and a vineyard and you have the county play a more active role as a leader in the area, you can crack down on bad behavior and make sure that the people who are trying to play by the rules and help support the industry are doing it right. So we'll see. I hear that they're trying to make changes, and I hope that addresses some of the concerns that you raise. I think they're valid ones. But I also know that the supermajority of the wineries in our area, including the one that's right up the stone throw across the street from my parents' house, do a good job of trying to manage their promotional activities to make them serve the industry well. But I appreciate your comments.
Thank you very much for your comments. I do want to say that actually there's some new news on that, in that the place that you're talking about, they have a relative just on the other side of the canyon, and they're busy setting that up now as a potential winery, and instead they have transferred the events over there. And so it's quite possible that under 841 they'll just move across the canyon and do it there. So it gets more complicated. And then there's actually another place nearby that would also like to be a winery. So
we'll continue to work on it out there.
Yeah. So it's not, I don't want it to be dismissed as this one bad operation. This is, we have to do some, logic of looking at to see what that means for similar and potential sorts. Thank you.
Thank you both for coming and testifying today. Colleagues, we're going to carry over. I want to be clear. We're going to carry over the public hearing on Senate Bill 41 and the work session.
So 841.
On 841. What did I say? 641? Senate Bill 841, we're going to carry over the public hearing and the work session. I want to go back and I want to clarify on Senate Bill 462 that we also carried over the public hearing and the work session on 462. All right, with that, any other business today? All right, we're going to close the committee.